Right? So these are those who are born from the womb. Right? Those born from eggs, birds, snakes, crocodiles, fish, tortoises, and similar terrestrials and aquatics. Those produced from hot moisture. Stinging and biting insects, lice, flies, bugs, and all such others. Those growing from seeds, slips, and shoots. Annual plants bearing flowers and fruits, perishing after their full fruit ripens. Right? Those bearing fruit without flowers are called vanaspati. Those bearing both, vriksha, right? Let's say like a jackfruit. There's no flowers, but it gives fruit. So you do have like that. There's a difference. These plants possess internal consciousness and experience pleasure and pain. Right? So the plants, even though we may not be able to understand it, they have consciousness, but it's internal. They don't understand what's outside. Right? They can't look around and enjoy the landscape. But they themselves can feel what's within their, you know, their body. Like that. So then they can, you know, where the sun is or where this is, and that's why then they'll move in different directions. That shows consciousness, it shows intelligence. But it's limited. From Brahma to these immovable creatures, all are subject to birth and death. Right? Okay. Okay, so then here the Vritu brought out the aspect of that, all of these subject to birth and death, that they all think that material existence is eternal, which is called Vaikuntha Brahma, and is full of happiness, Ananda Brahma, right? Because this is what keeps people here. They think, I will be happy eternally. That's why when Maya presents an option that you could be happy, immediately the living entity takes it, right? And if there is any something that you like, you expect it to always last, right? So these are symptoms of the soul. But the problem is that's why the shastras always talk about birth and death, or that it's temporary and full of misery, right? Because temporary means the Vaikuntha Brahma, and full of misery is the Ananda Brahma, right? Because the soul, we're eternal and full of bliss, so we think the material world's that way. But Lord Brahma has said from himself down to these immovable creatures, then they're all subject to birth and death, even though they think it should be something else. Disillusion and recreation. After creation, the Lord repeatedly destroys and recreates this universe, right? Because you have Sarga, Visar, and Visarga. So Visarga means secondary creation and recreation, right? So now he's defining that part of the creation. When he awakens, the world stirs. When he slumbers, the universe sleeps, right? So in Karana Dakshaya Vishnu, when he breathes out, then there's creation. When he breathes in, there's disillusion. And then within the universe, when Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu, when he sleeps at night, then the universe is inside is destroyed up to Satyaloka. And when he's awake, then it's manifest. Disillusion. When he sleeps, the corporal beings desist from action, their minds inert. When sweetly and contently slumbering, everything becomes absorbed in him. Recreation. When the soul enters into vegetable and animal seed, assuming a new body. Right? So then, that means is then, at these times when he's asleep, all the living entities are absorbed in him, and they're unconscious. Right? They're just absorbed in this sleeping principle. Then when he reawakens, then all the living entities then again go back into whatever forms that they have to through, you know, what we mentioned before, the through animal seed or from seeds. Does that make sense? After the Lord Okay, then now we're discussing Lord Vishnu as the origin of the sacred law. After the Lord taught these institutes to me, I taught them to the other sages. Bhrigu will now recite to you these institutes, having learned them from me. Right? So now it would be natural for the primary creation and the secondary creation to be described by Lord Brahma, because he's the authority, right? If Brahma explains how he created and how the Lord created before, no one will have a problem. He would be the best authority, right? So now the actual institutes of the law, right? Now that's going to be established by Bhrigu. Right? So the knowledge itself is this, but at the same time is without understanding how it came into being, then one will not be able to know how to connect that subject to the Lord. Right? So now Bhrigu, from now until the end of the 12th chapter, the end of the book, now it'll be Bhrigu talking, right, to the great sages. So topic 1b, so that was 1a, was the creation. Now is the origin of the sacred law. In other words, the origin of the universe, and now the origin of the sacred law. So first is the field of activities. Being thus addressed, Bhrigu spoke to the sages. Listen. Right. So now the manus. Six other high-minded, very, very powerful manus are Svaroskisha, Atami, Tamasa, Raivata, Chakshusha, and the son of Vivasvat. These manus, headed by Swayambhuva, produced and protected the creation. So Swayambhuva is the head of all the manus, right? So then he's the first, and then these other six. So they have all been, like we're now in Vivasvata manu. Does that make sense? So now time. So you're coming down how you're going to get to the sacred law. So now you have that the manus are there because you have manu samhita, which means the laws are for mankind. So here where the manus come from. Then you're going to have to perform activity. So you're going to have to understand time because action is through time. So time, earthly time, 30 muhurtas per day and 30 muhurtas per night. So he starts with a nimisha, which is the blink of an eye, which is 0.089 seconds, right? So then 18 nimishas is one kashta, which is 1.6 seconds. 30 kashta is one kala, so that becomes 48 seconds. 30 kalas are one muhurta, which is becomes 24 minutes. And as many muhurtas one day, 30 times 24 equals 12 hours. And then the same thing, night. So you get 60 of these 24 minutes, then you get 24 hours. Okay? That's how time is established. That makes sense? Sun divides days and nights, human and divine. Night for rest, day for exertion. Right? So then when you're supposed to do things is also established. Time of the manes. The dark fortnight is their day, the bright fortnight their night. So it's the opposite. When the night going from the full moon to the dark moon, that's the daytime for the forefathers. And when it's going from the dark moon to the full moon, that's their night. Right? So then that's so because we've defined the earthly one. Right? So 30 muhurtas is one day, and 30 muhurtas is a night. Now, 2 weeks of that is a night for the forefathers, right? And like that. So the gods, Uttarayan is their day, Dakshinayan is their night. Right? So the half of the year that the sun moves towards the north, that's the day for the demigods, and the 6 months it moves towards the south, that's their night. So that means one full year is one day. One full month is a day for the mains. And, 24 hours is our day. Then the four yugas. You have Satya, Treta, and Dwapara. Okay. 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 But here now the brief description of the duration of a night and a day of Brahma and the several ages of the world according to their order. Okay, so the Krita age, I think that comes up here. Yeah. The Krita age is 4,000 years of the gods, and then twilight preceding it consists of as many hundreds, and the twilight following it of the same number. So that means the Krita is 4,000 years, and there'll be 400 before and 400 after. That's the twilight. Then you'll have the Treta, which will be 3,000. It'll have 300 and 300 before and after. Dwapara will be 2,000, and then it'll have 2 and 2, and Kali Yuga is 1, and then 1 and 1. So if you add that up, then you get, it comes out to be 10. So you get a proper cycle. Yes. Do you blink?
Yes, Maharaj.
So then that's where you start from. So a blink is the amount of time that we can perceive, right? So a nimisha is basically that much of a second that we perceive, right? Does that make sense? So that's the point. So when we say a moment, we mean basically a nimisha. Right, because that's the human perception. So, what you can see, it's going to happen in that quick, and what you can experience happens in that time. So emotionally, things also can move at that speed, because otherwise everything's going fine, something's said wrong, the whole mood changes, you don't know what happened, because it was so sudden, it was one nimisha. So that's why we start here. This starts here. The Bhagavatam starts even shorter than that. It starts with the atom, how much time it takes for a sun ray to go over an atom. But that's there so you can get the calculation. But for us as humans, the nimisha is like where it becomes useful, right? Before that, it's just to give the foundation. Okay. So that's 4,000 times 360 human years is 1,440,000 years. The twilight preceding it is many hundreds. So that's 400 each. So that's 288,000 years. Total is 1,728,000,000 years. Does that make sense? So that means that will be this. That's how you get the Satyayuga. Because we always just get it in this final number. But that's including the age plus the sandhi, right, the junction. So the Satyayuga is 4,800 years of the gods. Treta is 3,600. Dwapara is 2,400. Kali Yuga is 1,200. So that's how we get our 432,000 years. Yes. Means the time is the same. It's just which one you call Treta and which one you call Dwapara. So the third one is always 2,400 years long, right? But generally that's Treta Yuga. So it's just a matter of it switches because when Krishna comes himself, then Pancharatra becomes the prominent process. So it switches. That's normally in Dwapara Yuga. Then it switches to Treta, so the two become reversed. But the length of time is the same. So that's 12,000 years of the gods, right? So that's 4,320,000,000 years. Yes?
How does this develop, how does this affect the development of society from just living in the forest and meditating to having kingdoms?
Because if you're a Paramahamsa, you don't really need, to have kings and everything like that. That means that the Varnas will be there, but no one needs to act within those according to the Varnashram. They're all Hamsas. But when Treta Yuga starts, then sacrifice starts, so then you start organizing in that way. But it's not so important in the Satya. The four yugas together is known as a Mahayuga, an age of the gods. Right. Time of Brahma is 1,000 yugas is this day, 1,000 is night. So these Mahayugas, 1,000 of these 4,320,000,000 years, so 1,000 of those is his day, and 1,000 of those is his night. Right? So, he's been around for a while. Only those knowing day and night of Brahman are acquainted with time. So you know time up to this, from the Nimisha up to this, then you can be said you understand time. You don't actually know time. Like that. This doesn't mean you can't tell what the numbers are on your watch, but you don't actually understand time, because all these things are functioning together. And to understand how the human being fits into this, then is there just like, you don't understand time, like in a few days, then I think around the 15th of July, then it goes into Dakshinayana. So the demigods go to sleep. That's their nighttime. Well, it means that's when their nighttime is, so a little bit, and then you go to sleep, and then they'll get up. So while they're asleep, so the 4 months of the Chaturmasya, that's when they sleep, you don't do any of these, all these material ceremonies, the samskaras. So marriages aren't performed, all these other things aren't performed. Garbhadan's not performed, these different aspects. Because the demigods are asleep, and they're the ones that take care of the management of all these affairs, so they're just not done. Does that make sense? You know, so that's why then if you don't know time, you won't understand this. You'll think, oh, why is it that during this time we can't do all these things? That's not practical. No, because the people who manage it are asleep. You know, can you go down and get your renew your driver's license if the office is closed? No, so they're asleep. Yes. It depends what community you're from. Like that. But the 4 months is the standard, like that. And then some people like to reduce it down to less. Yeah, but they get up at the Brahma Muhurta, so they're, after Kartik they get up. So it's still dark, but they get up. So then you can start things again. Okay? So creation and modification of the mind. After awakening, he who was asleep created mind, which is both real and unreal. Right? So he was asleep means Lord Vishnu. Mind, by the Lord's desire, performs the work of creation by modifying itself. From mind modifying itself is produced ether. The quality of ether is sound. From ether modifying itself springs the wind, possessing the quality of touch. From wind modifying itself proceeds light, possessing the quality of color. From light comes water, possessing taste. From water, earth, which has smell. Right? So in other words, the mind is created, and then from the mind everything else is created, and then that's how you get things manifest. Does that make sense? So it all comes back again to the mind. So that's why the mind becomes such a central feature. The purity of a mano is 71 Mahayugas. Right? Before mentioned, the age of the gods, 12,000 of their years, being multiplied by 71, constitutes that here in name is a purity of a mano. Right? So 14 manus are in the day of Brahma. So that means every time the manu changes, that's when all your primary demigods will also change. So every time manu changes, it means 14 times in a day of Brahma, that's when Indra, Varuna, Vayu, Agni, everybody changes. So that's the length of time. So for us, it's a long time, because you're taking 71 times 4,320,000,000 years. Right? So it's a long time, but it's that happens 14 times in a day of Brahma. Right? So if someone talks to Brahma about, you know, Indra, then he could easily ask which one, you know. Does that make sense? Because this is just in the day, not his night. So that all changes. So that's why it would have to be the, you know, now is the Indra in the Vaivasvata Manu. That's how you would identify. Does that make sense? So when the Bhagavatam talks about Indra, it could be any one of them. But it just means the person in that position has done. Yes.
How many times all in all has there been like
the change in manas? In Brahma's lifetime, I think the number comes up somewhere here. Okay. But there's basically 500,000 times that the manu changes. Means?
It means between Vishnu, Vridhi, and Ananda.
That's Oh, means that's 3/4 of a second if you're talking about Karana Dakshay Vishnu. So all this, what we're talking about here, happens in 3/4 of a second to Mahavishnu.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about Garbhadakshay Vishnu, then he sleeps at the time when Brahma sleeps. That's why Brahma sleeps, because he sleeps. The difference is those on Satya Yuga aren't dissolved, but those below Satya Loka, those below, then they are dissolved and go back into the Lord, and then when it's recreated, then it's all manifest again.
3.5 seconds
is how much in 3/4 of a second. Yeah. That means is how much is a breath.
Yeah, but how much is that for us in years?
The lifetime, 100 years of Brahma. So it's like 311 trillion years or something like that. The Manvantara's creations and destruction of the world are limitless. Qualities of the ages. Religion. In the Krita age, because Satyayuga is also called Krita, Dharma is four-footed and complete. Right? So that means truthfulness, austerity, mercy, and cleanliness is there, and no one follows any unlawful occupation, so therefore everything goes nicely. Right? Because when someone does an occupation they shouldn't do, that's when things get messed up. That's why the problem with Varna Shankar, they're going to do something they shouldn't. But if everyone does exactly what they're supposed to, then the age acts like Satya, even if it's not. Right? So when you have a golden age, means people follow their duty. That's what it is. In other ages, Dharma is deprived of one foot by theft, falsehood, and fraud. Right? So theft, falsehood, and fraud, these are the reasons that one foot becomes less. So that means they increase, then there's less feet. The life of mortals is proportioned according to the character of the age. Right? So in other words, how long the age is, that's how long humans live. Right? Does that make sense? So it just gets longer, like that. Various duties are prescribed for the different ages. In Krita, austerity. Treta, knowledge. Dvapara, sacrifices. And Kali, liberality alone. Yes. Liberality here basically means not the modern concept of being a liberal. That means basically charity. Right? So that's why that param upakar, welfare, is the only thing of this age. So the Harinam Samkirtan is the best way of performing this charitable work. Because in other ages, they don't have the austerity, the knowledge, the sacrifice. So simply by being liberal means, you know, sharing the wealth, sharing facilities, being kind to others, that's the only way. So the actual kindness is that of Krishna consciousness. That's why the modern person feels himself very up to date when he's liberal. But he doesn't understand that liberality not connected to the Lord actually isn't going to get much benefit. So real liberality is that which is connected to the Lord. Is that okay? So, yes, the devotee is the actual liberal. And these others are, you know, kind of basically narrow-minded, people who don't have faith in authority. Then you have the narrow-minded ones who have faith in authority. Yes.
Sir said that for Treta it's knowledge, so I guess this Dvapara is like shifty knowledge.
Yeah, so that's what he says, it reverses.
But why is it knowledge?
Because Pancharatra is knowledge. It's actually based, the main section of Pancharatra is jnana, which means you understand how the creation works, because you have to get from the Lord in Vaikuntha down to the deity. So that process, that's the major portion of the work. Like that. Then they explain what will be the rituals, what will be the daily activity, and what will be the festivals. So that's Pancharatra. So Pancharatra is considered to be a transcendental scripture. Right? It means your Vedas, other things aren't transcendental. They're dealing with the material phenomena. But the Vedanta and Pancharatra, those are considered transcendental. They're paravidya, like that. Is that okay? God-given duties of men. The separate duties of those from the Lord's mouth, arms, thighs, and feet. Okay, to Brahmins, he assigned teaching and studying the Veda. Right? Okay. Okay, there's a lot of things within this. Okay, there's a vritti within vrittis here. Vritti, studying the Vedas, offering sacrifices and charity, the common ashram duties of the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas. The Brahminical occupational duties of teaching, performing sacrifice and others, and receiving charity are to be avoided by the Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, as they've been assigned separate means of livelihood by the Lord. Right? And so in other words, of the six elements of duties, three of them are occupational, three of them are ashram. Right? So the three that are ashram are for all, but the three that are brahminical duties of occupation, then the kshatriyas and vaishyas have different duties, right? Brahmins who are intent on the means of gaining union with Brahman and firm in discharging their duties shall live by duly performing the following six acts, which are enumerated in their proper order. 1074. Right, so that's from the 10th chapter, 74th verse. Teaching, studying, sacrificing for himself, sacrificing for others, making gifts and receiving them are the six acts prescribed for a Brahmana. Right, so he's saying these are the things and their order. So that means, you know, in order of what is important, these are their duties. Right? Okay. Teaching, studying, sacrificing for himself, sacrificing for others. Oh, we just read that. So in the vritti, patana is studying, patina is teaching. Yajana is sacrificing for himself, yajana is sacrificing for others. Dana is giving charity, pratigraha is receiving charity. Right. So the study, sacrificing for himself, giving in charity, these are for everyone. But teaching, sacrificing for others, and receiving charity, that's only for the Brahmins. Right. But among the six acts ordained for him, three are his means of subsistence, namely sacrificing for others, teaching and accepting gifts from pure men. Riti, of these six activities, the Brahmin must perform three: study, sacrificing for himself, and giving in charity. The three activities of subsistence, teaching others, sacrificing for others, and accepting charity, may or may not be accepted. Instead, he may accept the means of rita, collecting unwanted discarded grains; mrita, begging; amrita, accepting that which comes with no endeavor. Right? Yes. Yeah, that's the thing, is that we'll think it doesn't go, but we'll come across a lot of verses that you see Prabhupada's quoting that are exactly coming from here.
It looks like directly Maharaj predicted the same.
Because it's mano. Because it's mano. It's mano. So it's just those that are, you know, the fundamental things, and those are just quoted as they are. There's no need of giving a different angle on them. If you want to bring out something, then you may give a different direction or a different word to it to bring out some other aspect so that you broaden your appreciation of it. But something like this that's so fundamental, there's no need of broadening. So it's exact. Like that. So you'll see any of the scriptures will say the same thing. Arthashastra will say the same thing. So they're all quoting from Dharma. Like that. Okay. Passing from the Brahmin to the Kshatriya, three acts incumbent on the former are forbidden. The same are likewise forbidden to a Vaishya. That is the settled rule. For Manu, the lord of creatures, Prajapati, has not prescribed them for men of those two castes. So in other words, teaching, sacrificing for others, and accepting of gifts, they're not given. Kshatriyas and Vaishyas can't do those. That's why you find when somebody wants to set up a business doing samskars, then he lasts about 6 months before he kind of like, you know, disappears. Why? Because he's not supposed to do it. And so he takes on all that karma, and it distracts him from the devotional process. Like that, because only a Brahmin can do that and not get overwhelmed by the thing. So it's not a business. And then if we think, okay, you know, it's not business. So these are brahminical acts. The temple can give facility for them to be done. The temple arranges. People can give a donation to the temple. But the temple then should take care of that Brahmin because he's the one doing it. Right? It's not a business deal. Oh, you did for us. So, like, no, like that. We have to be very, very careful on these things. Because things that are prescribed for the shut Brahmins, they stay with the Brahmins. Like that. To carry arms for striking and for throwing is prescribed for Kshatriyas as a means of sustenance. To trade, to rear cattle and agriculture for Vaishyas. But their duties, I mean, so that's how they're going to maintain themselves. But their duties are liberality, the study of the Veda, and performance of sacrifice. So here we see liberality is used means charity. So whenever he talks about liberality, it means being charitable, right? You know, because we have to remember this is 1830s English. Much more nice and pleasant, but, you know, not necessarily, how you say, contemporary. Among the several occupations, the most commendable are teaching the Veda for a Brahmin, protecting the people for a Kshatriya, and trade for a Vaishya. That's 10 and 80. Does that make sense? So that's also, because we're quoting here a lot of this from the 10th chapter, because in the 10th chapter it's describing what happens when people can't do their duties. Right? So first you have to describe what is, make it clear that they know what the duties are, then you can describe what you could do otherwise. Right? So all these have been quoted from there. The Kshatriya is commanded to protect the people. The Vaishya to tend cattle, trade, lend money, and cultivate land. To the Shudra, to serve without resentment. These are these other three varnas. So here it says to serve without resentment, not to serve. To serve without resentment. So for him to not resent means he has to have the proper mentality, but it means he has to be dealt with proper so he doesn't become resentful, that he has to work on it from his own personal character to not be. Right? In other words, if the Dwijas deal with the Shudras properly, they won't be resentful in the first place. But the problem is they're not dealt with properly, so they become resentful, and this gives rise to all the modern concepts of you know, how you say? You know, in the workplace, all the different laws and different things to govern that those who are managing the Shudras don't exploit them. Right? But if they're not being exploited in the first place, we don't need those rules. So it's not that the modern is more developed. No, the modern is more developed when you're dealing with people who don't follow the rules. So then you create rules for those people who don't follow the rules. But if they followed Manu, there wouldn't be need of the modern rules because it's already accomplished. Right? Does that make sense? Glory of the Brahminical Order. The Lord produced Brahmins in order that this universe might be preserved, right? Because the universe will function properly when the Brahmins are performing their duties and teaching others and people are practicing it. Then the universe runs nicely. When people don't follow the Brahminical order, then everything goes upside down. Of the intelligent, mankind is most excellent, and of men, the Brahmanas, right? Right. So here he's going, of created beings, the most excellent are said to be those that are animated, right? So inanimated are not as good as the ones who are animated, right? Of the animated, those which subsist by intelligence, like monkeys, their intelligence, or those who are clever, they're more intelligent, they're better. Of the intelligent, mankind, and of men, the Brahmins. Of Brahmins, those who know Brahman. So here, of Brahmins, those learned in the Veda. Of the learned, those who recognize the necessity and the manner of performing prescribed duties, right? So someone knows the Veda, then that's good. But then one who recognizes the necessity and manner of performing those prescribed duties, that's even better yet, right? And those who possess this knowledge, and of those who possess this knowledge, those who perform them, right? So then you know the necessity, so those who actually do it. And of the performance, those who know Brahman. Right, so probably gives the same definition. Right? So this is where it's coming from. The very birth of a Brahmin is an eternal incarnation of the sacred law, for he is born to fulfill the sacred law and thus comes to realize Brahman. Right, so in the Vritti, Brahmanam janatiti Brahman. Brahmana. One who knows Brahman is known as a Brahmana. Right? So it's the second birth that qualifies the brahmana. Then it's stated by Manu. Of him who gives natural birth and of him who gives the knowledge of the Veda, the giver of the Veda is the more venerable father. For the birth, for the sake of the Veda, ensures eternal rewards, both in this life and after death. That's second chapter, 146. Okay, then continue. Let him consider that he received a mere animal existence when his parents begat him through mutual affection, and when he was born from the womb of his mother. But that birth from which a teacher acquainted with the whole Veda, in accordance with the law, procures for him through the Savitri, is real, exempt from age and death. Savitri means Gayatri. So in other words, from the parents, because you're born because of their mutual affection, that's why you're there, right? It wasn't because necessarily some great philosophical or spiritual consideration. So then, because if it's a matter of, no, but we want to make him Krishna conscious, you can go out on the street and make people Krishna conscious. But we want to get that interaction of the child and all those feelings and emotions. That's why people have children, right? Then they're dovetailing that by having the children in a Krishna conscious state for the purpose of Krishna consciousness, right? Let's be very clear here. Therefore, the one who is the teacher who brings one into understanding the Veda and the law, so it means the Veda and how to apply the Veda in your life, that's the more venerable father, right? That birth is considered a higher birth, right? So that's why the first birth is animal birth, the second is then actual human. Therefore, by consciously practicing the values and lifestyle of the Brahminical culture and becoming inquisitive into the nature of existence for the purpose of realizing our eternal relationship with the Lord, does one achieve actual Brahminical status. So that's actually a Brahmin. Otherwise, he's born in the Brahmin family, then there's some consideration, but he's not actually a Brahmin until this. Okay. And then we see here alone that he says, be pleased, O Divine One, to declare to us precisely and in due order the sacred laws of each of the four chief varnas and the intermediate ones. For thou alone, O Lord, knowest the purport. In other words, the rites and the knowledge of the soul taught in connection with it for the purpose of realizing the self-existent, who is unknowable and unfathomable. Right? So in other words, the law is only for the purpose of becoming conscious of Krishna. Does that make sense? No? All that kind of how that connects together? Right? So a devotee, because he's knowing Krishna, that establishes him as a Brahmin by lifestyle, right? By duty, but not necessarily by occupation. Right? Occupation you'll do according to your nature. Now, because everybody is the pure soul, that means everybody could preach, right? Do Harinam. Things like this, because that's beyond, that's the nature of the soul. But when it comes to making money, you're going to make money according to your conditioned nature. So at that time, then we don't get all, you know, so-called pragmatic and then try to make money off of mixing everything and doing whatever we like. Does that make some sense? This is important, right? Because if the administrators make the problem, then you create more problem. If individuals do it, that's another thing. But if the Brahmins and Kshatriyas get it wrong, that's where it really becomes a difficulty. Right? Does that make sense? Remember, we always have to keep in mind the last time that the Kshatriyas really got off track, then Parasuram, they had to be straightened out by a Brahmin who happened to be Parasuram. Right? A Brahmin is born to protect the treasury of the law. A Brahmin coming into existence is born as the highest on earth, the Lord of all created beings, for the protection of the treasury of the law. Whatever exists in this world is the property of the Brahman. On account of the excellence of his origin, the Brahman is indeed entitled to all. The Brahman eats but his own food, wears but his own apparel, bestows but his own in alms. Other mortals subsist through the goodwill of the Brahmins. In other words, through training, that's actually how everything works. So it's because you're doing your duty, that's how everything works for you. So it's actually because of the Brahmins that everything works, right? Just like later on we'll see is that in practicality, when you're in managing it, it's because of grihastas, the whole Varnashram system is there. Because if there's no grihasthas, you don't have any kids to become brahmacharis. Or if there's no grihasthas, there's no vanaprasthas and sannyasis. It's because there's grihasthas, you have brahmin, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras. Right? Does that make sense? So that's how it's run. But it's actually because it's based on the Dharma, on the law, on the Veda, and that's taught by the Brahmins. So it's actually their system. Right? So if the Brahminical is the prominent, then the law becomes very easy. But if not, if it drops down to the others, then they get into all kinds of other atheistic kind of approaches. And so then there's always a problem. Right? So now we see as we established the law, right? And then the ages by which it functions, how you know what's prominent, right? Because in one age, one element is prominent, right? And so then he's created the Varnashram to make sure that the law is followed, and of that, the Brahmins to make sure that everybody else knows how to follow it. Is that okay? Yes.
The intelligent mankind, who are other intelligent?
Monkeys, crows, foxes. You know, I mean, a crow lives by intelligence, right? It can tell when things are happening and stuff like that. It knows when you threw the garbage out, right? The dog just happens to be walking by and notices the garbage. The crow knows it's garbage time, you know. You know, so it lives by... Every living entity uses some intelligence, but, you know, but where that's the prominent element. Does that make sense? Like that. Yes.
Fifty.
Wow, cool.
That was one offering of to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur a long time ago in India. So I was just thinking, you know, there's kind of more devotees than 50 in the world, and only men of the mental goodness would change everything.
See, the thing is, because you have your mixed, you have the practical thing of one who's situated in goodness. So here we could mean also pure goodness. So on the transcendental platform, that could change the world. Or you can mean goodness who their life functions based on goodness. Because even though a devotee, still the modes they're conditioned by may not be goodness, right? Passion, ignorance, like what we were discussing before. If we have doubt in the Vedas, that's not the mode of goodness. They may be intelligent, right? But we have to remember intelligence is created from passion. So just being intelligent doesn't automatically put you in goodness, because we'll think, oh, these smart people, no, there's passion, because it's based on knowledge, which is comes from the senses. That's why that goes together. The academics only accept what they can perceive with the senses, right? At the same time, that means they're actually expression of themselves is through the senses. That's why you see many times the academics, especially the scientists, are very, very gross in their sensual behavior, like that. Because it's all in that line of the mode of passion, the intelligence, the senses. That's why it has to be connected to proper consciousness, then it lifts it up. So the activity then comes to a higher platform. Because if the senses are engaged on naishkarmya, that's mode of goodness. But if the senses aren't engaged, it's still intelligence that's operating them. But it doesn't mean that the result is stemming from the mode of goodness. Right? Because it stems from passion, so you get a result in passion. That's why we need to analyze all these things so we can see that there's multiple things happening at once. You know, just like a cow, its body is controlled by the mode of goodness, but the soul in the cow's body is in the mode of ignorance. Otherwise, why are they an animal? You understand? But they're a living entity in ignorance that's in the mode of goodness of ignorance. Right? Does that make sense? Because ignorance can be ignorance, ignorance, passion, ignorance, goodness, ignorance. Then passion will have ignorance, passion, goodness, passion. Then goodness will have ignorance, passion, ignorance, goodness, passion, goodness, and goodness. Right? That'll be described in the 12th chapter. So then you can have all these mixes. So that's why sometimes it becomes strange. How can you have this? So, you know, he's a preacher in this, and now suddenly he's engaged in all this nonsense. So then what's the conclusion? Will be, he never was brahminical, he cheated us, we've been, you know, cheated and all that, this is abuse, this is all these different things, because he's always been in this lower, no. In goodness, it's mixed, goodness means it's mixed with passion and ignorance, just the passion became prominent, ignorance became prominent. You know, he wasn't careful, so that, just like a knife cuts, you're not careful, you get cut yourself. It doesn't mean that it changes the nature. You understand? One has to be able to function with these, understanding these multiple elements at once. Otherwise, one won't know how to deal. Otherwise, why is there a whole chapter on punishments for Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra if they're not still that after they perform the activity? Right? Because otherwise, if they were always cheating, no, they weren't always cheating. They were doing nice. But it's not that one can't get distracted. That's what Maya does for a living, right? Is, you know, try to distract. So if he became distracted, then it means he distracted from the brahminical platform. So how do you deal with someone distracted from the brahminical platform? Not that, oh, he was always cheating, he was never a Brahmin. That's uninformed, that's overwhelmed by morality, that's simplistic. One can't deal with many things at once. Does that make sense? Because you'll come across this stuff, especially when you're dealing with somebody who's done something wrong. You can deal with it, but the problem is your community of devotees will have less ability to deal with it because of these less in being informed, less trained, more simplistic. So they're going to expect, you know, very great punishments. But the only actual thing that does anything in this world is something connected to Krishna. Right? That's the only thing the only reformation comes through that. You have to actually think you're the body to think a bodily activity is going to reform the soul. You understand? But because people do identify with the body, that's where Manu gives things that will do both. But unless you follow Shastra and you give something outside of that, then you'll get the reaction, right? Manu mentions that if the king judges properly something, you know, according to Shastra and according to the individual, then 100% of the blame falls on the criminal and zero falls on the king and the judges and the witnesses. But if he judges it wrongly, right, by his own speculation and that, then one quarter of the fault of the wrong action, of the sin, falls on the king, one quarter on the judges, one quarter on the witnesses, and only one quarter on the criminal. So the modern, why is it that the modern criminals don't get such bad reactions? Right? The life goes nice, because three quarters of the sin of their criminal act falls on all these other people. Right? In the Vedic, it all fell on the criminal. Right? So, is that okay? Yeah? Okay. So now we're talking about the sacred law. In order to clearly settle everyone's duties, right? Because otherwise you can say, oh no, but everybody can do everything, everyone's equal, as if, but you know. Manu composed the sacred law, right? So this Manu means Krishna, and it means Brahma, has put it together, and then now Manu himself establishes it for us, right? Study of these institutes is the best means of securing welfare, right? You want material facility, you want spiritual wealth. This is the best way to do it, right? Okay, so this is here. A Brahmin... a learned Brahmin must carefully study them, and he must duly instruct his pupils in them, but no one else shall do it, right? So this is not something that you just put up. Study of Manu is not something you just put up as a seminar that anybody can teach, right? In other words, someone who has the brahminical nature, they teach these. Everybody else practices them, but only they teach them, right? Because otherwise there'll be some other angle. There'll be an administrative angle, or a economic angle to it. So the Brahmins, it's not like that. It's clean from that. It's just these are the institutes. And you can apply it as a religiously, you know, economically, administratively. That's the next step. Right? A Brahmin who studies these institutes and faithfully fulfills his duties prescribed therein is never tainted by sins arising from thoughts, words, or deeds. He sanctifies his company, his kinsmen, several seven ancestors, and seven descendants, and he alone deserves to possess this whole earth. To study this work is the best means of securing welfare. It increases understanding. It procures fame and long life. It leads to supreme bliss. So that means to study. So that means any of the dwijas study it. But only the Brahmin should teach it. Right? That doesn't mean when you're saying to others, oh, you have to do this and that, and you're quoting from there, that's fine. But to teach it as an occupation, that only a Brahmin would do. The rule of conduct is transcendent law taught in revealed texts and tradition. So here he uses transcendent law, means it's always applies, not that, oh, it's now 2011, it doesn't apply. No, it's transcendent. In this work, the sacred law has been fully stated, as well as the good and bad qualities of human actions. And the immemorial rule of conduct, right? So it's not time-bound, to be followed by the four varnas. The rule of conduct is transcendent law, whether it be taught in the revealed scriptures or in the sacred tradition. Hence, a twice-born man who possesses regard for himself should always be careful to follow it. Right, so this law is there. We see how the great personalities have followed it, and we see that the scriptures talk about it. Right, so the scriptures are there. Great personalities apply it in their life. That becomes tradition. So from both of these, you can get it. Right. He who duly follows the rule of conduct will obtain the full reward. Okay, a Brahmana who departs from the rule of conduct does not reap the fruit of the Veda. Does not yet. Yeah, but he who duly follows it will obtain the full reward. The sages who saw that the sacred law is thus grounded on the rule of conduct have taken good conduct to be the most excellent rule of all austerity. Right? So austerity is your prescribed duty, so the good conduct is the rule. Now we can see here the parallels. This is where the modern man gets his ideas from, so that he says being good and being nice is you know, the highest thing. Right? And before it mentioned that what was the other one? That in Kali Yuga, then liberality, you know, charity or welfare aspect is the highest, is the main central principle of Dharma, right? So these elements which are already established in the Shastra, these are then people are picking up and finding that they work. So then when they profess them, it doesn't mean that they become modern, right? They're already Shastric. That's why they work. So the liberals are trying to come in line with these, but they're not doing so by authority. That's the problem with the liberal. There's no authority. Right? Whatever anybody thinks or feels, anybody, why can you say your what you think is right? They also have their opinion. That's also right. Isn't this liberal speak? Right? So that's the point. No, conservatives, no, there's a law. You have to follow it. So that's the difficulty. The liberal, it's nice that they're considering the individual, but the weakness is they don't consider authority. Right? And without authority, what we've been doing up to now is establishing authority, and it'll continue that way. Right? So without authority, nothing has any meaning. Otherwise, everybody has an idea. So why an adult over a child? They can say, well, the immature. Who's to say that maturity is actually the best thing? The kids, they all, you know, love everybody and everything like that, so they're innocent. So maybe their feelings are actually better than the adults. You know, we should be striving to become like the children, right? We could say this to the liberals. So then who is it? You know, and then it gets down to, you know, the rock. It's also part of God's creation. Why are you putting your life more important than this rock? But people will say animate is more important than inanimate. Right? Otherwise, why they go out into the forest, cut down the trees, take the rocks and everything, and then make business and live? Why? Because it's understood animate is more important than inanimate. But who said animate was more important than inanimate? Manu. right? Of living entities, the inanimate is not, the animate's better than the inanimate. Of the animate, then the humans are better. Of the humans, then the Brahmins. Of the Brahmins, one in knowledge. Of what was in knowledge, one who actually understands to practice that knowledge, you know, and apply it is better. One who actually does practice it is better yet. One who, by practicing, has realized that he's the best. Right? That's up to here. And then we take it a step further. One who has understood that in relationship with Krishna, they're the best. Yeah. Yeah, so it just keeps going. So it's just a matter of how far you take it. Like here, we'll give 10 qualities of what you need to follow Varnashram, because they're general. But Narad Muni in the 7th canto, he's explaining the same knowledge, because he said, I explained this to my 10 sons. So this is Bhrigu's explanation. But in Bhagavatam, that's Narad Muni's explanation. You know, the same knowledge, but because it's coming from the devotional angle, he brings out, you know, the 9 aspects of devotional service as part of the necessities of Varnashram. Does that make sense? So it's just a matter of where you're bringing it out, but the fundamentals are the same, right? Okay, so now we get into the 25 topics of the sacred law, right? We've already discussed one of them, leaving. Okay. So creation, the sacraments, studentship, respect, graduation, marriage rites, the great sacrifices, which means the the debts we owe to the sages, the forefathers, the demigods, living entities in general, and I think the ghosts. Shraddha rites, modes of gaining subsistence, duties of a snatika, lawful and forbidden food, purification, women, hermits, sannyas, duty of kings, manner of deciding lawsuits, examination of witnesses, laws concerning husband and wife, inheritance, gambling, removal of men noxious like thorns, behavior of vaishyas and shudras, mixed castes, the law for times of distress, penances, transmigration, the results of action, attaining the supreme bliss, and examination of good and bad qualities of action. Right. So then in this, he also has the primeval laws of countries and castes. Okay. Okay. Then in this verse, okay. What are we saying? Primeval laws of countries, of castes, of families, and the rules concerning heretics and companies, of traders and the like. While the 25 topics mentioned in verses 1 to 11 are listed in the text chronologically, the topics of this verse are interspersed throughout the discussions. So this verse is then, okay, yeah. The primeval laws of countries, castes, okay, these things come up here and there whenever they apply. So you have something that applies in one country and another. You're dealing with one kind of different group or with families or heretics, business, economic considerations. Those will come throughout the text. But the work does go in exact chronological order of what's mentioned here. So as Manu formally promulgated these institutes, so learn ye also from me. So Bhrigu's saying, Manu or Brahma taught it to me. Brahma said, you know, I will teach this to you in the same way. Just as Brahma said, I heard this from Vishnu, right, as the original Manu, then I, as Manu, taught it to my sons, right, headed by Swayambhuva, who's Manu. And now Bhrigu will speak this, right, because they're sages, so now it may not look good if, because you're teaching it, so therefore a Brahman teaches it, because Swayambhuva is a Kshatriya, so therefore then Bhrigu is teaching. Right? Plus, it's sages who are questioning, so it will be natural that a Brahmin would speak. If these were great kings, then Swayambhuva might then give them direction how to apply this. Right. So now we come to the second chapter, right? Discourse 2. Yes. Which? Vritis in here. By
this original translator, by
No, no, no. The original translator only did the actual verses.
So this is added by devotees?
Yes. Discourse 2. Learn that sacred law which is followed by men, learned in the Veda, and assented to in their hearts by the virtuous, who are ever exempt from hatred and inordinate affection. Right? In other words, if there's hatred and too much affection, then one will not be able to understand this properly. So you should learn the sacred law from those who their hatred and attachment are balanced, right? It's not too, it's in control, right? Because otherwise, then there's always going to be a bias. To act from desire is not laudable. It means if you'll notice that before the verses, sometimes you have that little squiggle, I don't know what you call it, a little sideways little things. Those verses are very prominent. It means generally the whole verse as it is very, gives a main conclusion, or the whole verse is applicable, and then other ones are not. So when we come to those, then we may read just from the direct text rather than from the sutra. To act from desire is not laudable, yet exemption from desire is not found. Right? Now you come up with a problem. To act from desire that you want a result, that's not considered good. But to act from without, no action is done without desire. So how do you balance that? Right? From desire, sacrifices, vows, and laws are kept with the idea of reward. So somebody does good work only because they think I'll get a good result. So even though it's not good, it still ends up, it's useful. Right? Not a single act appears to be done by man free from desire. Right? So there hasn't been an act previously ever done that it wasn't done by desire. That makes sense? So that's why the desire then is in line with the scriptures, then because it's your duty, then it becomes austerity. So then it becomes religious, right? Now if you're doing that to please the Lord, then it becomes transcendental, right? But doing it nice karma is what the scriptures are recommending, that you perform the duty because without the attachment to the results. But that will only give you liberation, right? But when nice karma is performed to please the Lord, right? Then that's devotional, right? I do the act because I'm supposed to. It'll give a result. I'm not interested in the result. Why? Because I want to get out of the world. What do I need the result for? So you get liberation. But if it's, I'm doing this activity to get this result, but I'm not interested in the result, that'll get you out of the material world. But I want the result for Krishna. That will get you into the spiritual world. Yes?
Maharaj, you say that the impersonalists are preaching to their Grihastha followers, basically Naishkarmiya.
Yes, because it gets liberation.
So, what kind of work do they do? Because, when we do Karma Yoga, we are doing some service for Krishna.
They do it because that's the law. You follow the duty because you're supposed to, then you'll get liberation.
But is it that they just do any work and they are not attached to?
What do you mean by any work? If it's their duty, then yes. They go to a factory because either they work there or they own it. So either a Shudra there or they're the Vaishya there. Right? So they're performing their duties as given in the Shastra. So it's not just any work. You see, in other words, we have to give up our attachment to liberation, that it's something so special. Any karmi nonsense practices the elements given in the Shastra without a desire for the result will get liberated. It's that simple. Right? But liberation's temporary. So, how you say? Liberation's overrated, you could say. So we're not interested. We want to go back to Godhead. We want to please Krishna, develop devotion for Him. Does that make sense? Because that's what's pleasing to Him. Yes.
How does he do it?
What aspect do you want to take?
Like, what is it in his work compared to like an ordinary materialistic person who just does it for the result?
But we've already now you've left out what we were just talking about. The person is doing it his work because it's his duty, right? So where's that one in your example? So you have the person that's doing it simply because he wants the result. You have a person who's doing it because that's his duty and he wants the result. You have the person who's doing it because it's his duty, he doesn't want the result. You have the person who's doing it because it's his duty, doesn't want the result for himself but wants it for Krishna. So you have all those.
So for a devotee,
why is he doing the work? Why would the guy be going to the factory and doing work?
Well, he wants the money.
Okay, why does he want the money? Why does he want to maintain his family?
Because that's his position.
And why would that be his position?
Because Krishna has put him in
that position. Krishna put him in that position. That he needs to be grihastha, Krishna put him there. Or, but you weren't listening what was said here? As the living entities, according to their mind, that's where they're placed in the creation. His desire. Okay, so that's your desire. So, where's Krishna in this? You know what I'm saying? If you're going to give the example of how to find Krishna, coming from the Krishna consciousness angle, why did you leave out Krishna? Why would he want to maintain his family?
That's his position in the Varnashram.
Why would that be his position in the Varnashram? And due to his desires, so then they reached the end of the line there, the dead end, and you didn't connect it to the Lord. So he wants to make his family Krishna conscious, or he just likes having sex with his wife, and somehow or another kids are just the byproduct. And so therefore he needs money, because if he doesn't have money, his wife won't have sex with him, right? So is that how it works? No, he wants to raise his family in Krishna consciousness. So you need facility to do that. So that's why he works and gets money. You understand? So that's the simplest. Now he could understand that he's performing his duty because he has to get money. So therefore he is, a shudra by nature because he's working for the guy that owns the factory. So therefore the guy who owns the factory is the Vaishya and he's the shudra. So he should be working, according to Manu, without resentment. So he should do his duties nicely. Right? Because if he does his duties nicely, the Vaishya makes money. If the Vaishya makes money, then there's money for him to get paid. And if he gets paid, then he's able to do these other aspects. Right? So therefore it's because of the law, that's why he's doing what he's doing. Right, and then who gave the law? Krishna gave the law. So he's following the rule according to how Krishna created employer-employee. Right? Or you could look at the element is that, you know, he's in the employer is in the position, the masculine position, he's in the feminine position. So therefore he's doing his duties according to, you know, how he's being directed by. You understand? But as a leader, then you have to take care of the employees according to their needs, and that's why then they'll respond and work nicely. Right? You understand? Because it's God's laws. He's made them. So if you want to look at it from the metaphysical, you want to look at it from the shastric, you want to look at it from the devotional, it means you have all these different options. Is that okay? He who persists in discharging prescribed duties reaches the deathless state. Right? He who persists in discharging these prescribed duties in the right manner reaches the deathless state, and even in this life obtains the fulfillment of all the desires he may have conceived. Right. So if you perform your prescribed duties, then even what you want materially, you'll get. Not only that, you'll get to the deathless state. So we understand now this deathless state can mean three things. Right? For the devotee, it means deathless means Vaikuntha. For the jnani, it means Brahman. And for the karmi, it means the heavenly planets. Right? Does that make sense? So according to the point is you'll get whatever you do. What is meant here is the devotional platform, because remember, the invocation said how to obtain the Supreme Lord. So that's actually what this means. But the wording is such that even those who aren't interested in this will still follow it. So the jnanis and karmis will still follow all these rules, and it will make a favorable environment for devotees to practice Krishna consciousness. The source of the sacred law. Okay, so in other words, the basis of... Four sources of sacred law. The whole Veda, Shruti, is the first source of the sacred law. Next, the tradition, Smriti, and the various virtuous conduct of those who know the Veda further, and also the customs of holy men, and finally, self-satisfaction. Right? These four, this is how you judge, means... Now, this is the sacred law, right? So when we say something's Vedic or not Vedic, right? So now when devotees will mention, they'll only talk about the first or this first and second, but they leave out the third and the fourth, right? So that's why they're unable to make it practical or see its practical application. The first, the Shruti, that's the Veda. The second source is the tradition, Smriti. So all the four Vedas, that's Shruti. All the other scriptures, like including Manu here, this is Smriti. Right? What is Smriti? Smriti is the understandings and practice of the great personalities who follow the Veda. Right? So, therefore, then, their conversations and their actions, those are documented in Smriti. Does that make sense? So that's why we have there. The Veda says something, and then we have, you know, like the Bhagavatam, what Parikshit Maharaj does in the Bhagavatam. Now that's Smriti, right? So that's tradition, right? Why do we call it tradition? Because that's what the great personalities do. It works, right? They recommend it, others follow it, it works, right? So that's the second. The virtuous conduct of those who know the Vedic further, right? So how they've, and the customs of holy men. So the conduct of those who know the scriptures and the customs that they regularly follow of those personalities. That's the third, right? Yes?
What is the position of the Chaturshloki of Srimad Bhagavatam?
The Chaturshloki.
Yeah, and the rest is
elaboration. No, but that's what Shruti is based on, right? Means it comes to us through Smriti, but it's what the Shruti is actually based on. The whole Veda is based on those four verses. Like that. So if you know those four verses, you know the Veda. Right? You don't know those four verses, then you might get confused. Does that make sense? Yes.
And the Bhagavad Gita is technically Smriti,
but it's Shruti. It's Smriti. It's also Smriti, because it comes in a conversation. Because the thing is we'll always look at something in a hierarchy that it's always better, you know, the higher up it is, because that's where, you know, the buck ends means you have the buck, not necessarily that you're responsible, that you have the buck, right? So, but the point is Krishna, as it expands, that's where it gets interesting. Like, what's more interesting, your child or your grandchild? You understand? Then you have the great-grandchild. You understand? So the whole point is as it expands, so you have the Veda, then you have the Smriti, because that's how the personalities or the devotees follow the Veda. So that's more interesting, right? Then it comes down to virtuous conduct and the customs of holy men. So that will be like within the Sampradaya, you know, the great sages and the people that we quote and, you know, what Prabhupada does and what he says and like this, or other advanced personalities like that. So that becomes even more. That's why the Chaitanya Charitamrita is considered higher, even though it's actually the third. It's documenting this third point. The Veda is documenting the first, right? The other literature is the second. The Purana is the second. But the Chaitanya Charitamrita is the third, right? So as it goes, it gets sweeter. And then the fourth is finally self-satisfaction. It means yourself, you're satisfied in following it. So in other words, you should be satisfied doing what you're doing, but what you're doing should be based on the other three. If it's not based on the other three, it's not Vedic. At the same time, as if these other three aren't applied to the individual so he's comfortable with it, it's also not complete. Right? So in that's why I say when devotees say they followed Varnashram, but and they weren't satisfied, means they didn't follow Varnashram, because Varnashram means the fourth element is it has to work for you. You have to be comfortable with it. Right? Does that make sense? It means that's in performing your duties. That doesn't mean, oh, I'm not comfortable performing my duties, so for me to be comfortable, I wouldn't perform duties. You do have a place in Manu, but that'll come in the 10th chapter when it talks about the various tribes and stuff. Means it's talking about virtuous conducts of those who know the Veda and the customs of holy men. So it's talking about devotees who are practicing. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And those go back to the Veda. Yeah. Because generally what they're doing is, when you say Veda, for us, we'll quote Upanishads. Right? We don't, not necessarily the Samhita of the Veda, but Upanishads. Like the Chaitanya Shikshamrita by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He gives the Dasamulan all the evidence of everything he takes back to an Upanishadic verse. And Prabhupada in one place also mentions that. That if it can't be taken back to the Veda or to the Upanishads and Vedanta, it doesn't have a basis. He's compiled them. He hasn't written them. Veda is not written. He's compiled. That's why he's compiled the Veda, because that knowledge is already there. It's just all he did was take it, instead of it being one Veda, which is the Atharva. And in the Atharva, it has the riks, you know, the hymns, it has the prose, and it has the songs, the samans, right? So he separated them and took all the riks and put it in one place. That's the Rig Veda. He took all the prose and put it in one place. That's the Yajur Veda. And he took all the samans and put it in one place, that's the Samaveda. And then what's ever left is still called Atharva. Right? But before, all those other three are within the Atharva. Because it's all just one word, it's just the Veda. So someone could study the whole Veda and from that get an understanding of what to do. But as people are less intelligent, it's divided into four, so by studying one of them, then you could get a complete understanding. Right? Okay, how are we doing? Okay, a few more minutes. So that's a very important thing. Then, whatever law has been ordained for any person by Manu, that has been fully declared in the Veda, for that sage was omniscient. So that means whatever law is being given here is in the Veda. And so the Veda is eternal. So that means the laws given by Manu are eternal. So then you have to know what's the principle of them to, and then be able to apply it to the situation, right? Self-satisfaction. Does that make sense? So that's the point. It has to match, right? It has to match. So that's the point, is there's no question of it not being applicable. Detail, yes, you may have to, because detail is what is self-satisfaction about. Principle is not a matter. That's, one's always going to be happy with that. Right? It's just like that you're going to eat, right? Is anybody going to be disturbed about that? You're hungry, you want to eat, right? But that's the principle. You're hungry, so you eat. Now, what you're going to eat, that's a detail. Now, you might want to eat this, someone else wants to eat that, and so on. So it's in details that problems come up. There's no problem in principle. Everybody will agree with the principle. Right, but it'll be said to be theory until it's applied. But to say principle is theory, that's not real, because all detail is based on principle. With knowledge, one should be intent on the performance of duty. So with knowledge, right, because we say that's the chit potency, knowledge and action, right, consciousness and action. So, and Krishna's saying in the Gita, with knowledge perform your duties, right, so it's the same thing. So Manu is saying the same. It's the same point. It's in line with the Gita. So just to do them with sentiment, that's not enough. And just to have knowledge and not perform duties, that's also useless, right? But because the jnani will consider himself superior to the karmi, therefore the person who has knowledge who doesn't do duties will consider himself superior to the person who does duties but doesn't know why. But both of them have missed the point, right? You're supposed to do duties with knowledge. Who obeys the law? Who obeys the law in the revealed text and sacred tradition achieves success. Right? You don't follow the laws, you won't achieve success. Right? So if you're following the laws by previous karma, you don't know that you're following the laws, but you're doing it and getting the success, one should not think that he did something outside of, you know, what the Shastra says. No, he did it, he just didn't know he did it. That's all. One should not doubt the Veda or the sacred law. But by Shruti, revelation, is meant the Veda. And by Smriti, tradition, the institutes of the sacred law. So here, now they're talking Smriti will, from now on, always be referred to as, meaning Manu, means this Manu, Samhita. That's the Smriti, right? Because we're not talking about Ayurveda or another Smriti. Those two must not be called into question in any manner, since from those two the sacred law shone forth. Right? So you can't doubt these two. One can discuss it till you find how it practically applies. That you can do. There can be a discussion about a doubt on what's the best way to apply it, but one can never doubt the Veda and the Smriti, you know. That can't happen. You know, but to find the right thing, just like, you know, you're driving from one place to another. You can't doubt that, but you might doubt, well, should we take, you know, the main road or should we go by the back roads or, you know, like that. That you may discuss. But the point that you're going to take your car and drive it from here to there, you can't doubt. So in the same way, the Veda, the Shruti and the Smriti can't be doubted. You know, there can be discussion how to apply it, but that can't be because the Veda is given by God. Right, so it's correct, and the Smriti is what the great sages who are God conscious have declared. Does that make sense? So that shouldn't happen. Okay, every twice born man who, relying on the institutes of dialectics, means debate, right, or in this case modern, like rhetoric, because they don't even get back to logic, actually, treats with contempt these two sources of the law, must be cast out by the virtuous as an atheist and a scorner of the Veda. Right? So when I say people look at it with this way and it's atheistic, I'm just quoting this verse. Right? In other words, if using logic they throw out the Shruti and Smriti and think they've come up with a better conclusion, they're an atheist. And so you should avoid their association. It's that simple. Yes?
This is a definition of atheist.
Yeah. An atheist is someone who doesn't accept the scriptures. Right? Because the scriptures are given by God and the devotees. That doesn't mean you can't discuss them and try to understand them, but you can't doubt that it's not correct. Just we don't understand it. So someone's saying the Bhagavatam is an allegory because we don't understand how the universe functions in the way it's described. To say that's atheistic, to say I don't understand it and so how could I understand it, that would be appropriate. So you have faith in it, though you may not understand it. Yes.
Certain demons, the Varna Kashyapu, they were preaching from the Vedas.
But they're just misapplying. That doesn't make the Veda any less valid. Because Hiranyakashipu, after his brother was killed, then he's preaching Vedanta philosophy to the women of the family. So was his preaching wrong? Was what he was saying wrong? Yes or no?
No.
Did it get the effect that Vedanta should get? Right? Freedom from the bodily consciousness, so they now weren't lamenting over the loss of Hiranyaksha. Right? But his motive for that wasn't transcendental. That's where it's the materialistic. But the method itself was fine. That's why it's in the Bhagavatam. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there.
But he is an atheist.
He's an atheist because how he uses it is for some other purpose, because he thinks ultimately he's supreme. So he's not atheist that he doubts the scriptures. He's atheist because he doubts God. Like that. You know, so you have to see is that doubting the Lord or the scriptures, one could say, well, that's dogmatic. No, it's not. We can discuss it. Just for information. Dogmatic means you're not willing to discuss it. Not that you're fixed in it and saying this is the only way it is. That's not dogmatic. That's just, you know, strong faith. Dogmatic means you're not willing to discuss it. You know, you say, Jesus is God. Well, so what does that mean? Oh, we don't talk about that. That's dogmatic. So we'll discuss anything. So we're not dogmatic. Some people try to use that just to make you throw you off. But that's what is meant here, dialectics. They use debate. Treats with contempt those two sources of the law. Right? That's atheism. So it shouldn't be allowed. Right? Technically, as leaders, you shouldn't allow it. Right? People have to have faith in the scriptures like that. But you can discuss how to practically apply it. That's there. Because that's what the whole point is that otherwise, why do you need leaders if it's so obvious? If it's so obvious, then you don't need leaders, right? Isn't it? Like you go to the petrol station, right? And nobody's there. You take your credit card, put it in the machine, push the buttons how much you want, it takes off the, you know, how much it's worth, and then you put the petrol in it. You don't need anybody, right? It's that straightforward, right? But the point is you need leaders because this has to be applied to the individual. That's why, so you have to discuss how to apply this to the individual. Because if it was just a generic thing, what do we need leaders for? Anybody could interpret the law because it just says, if this happens, you do this. Finish. Does that make sense? So it's because of the personal aspect, that's why there's leadership. So then to throw out leadership for bureaucracy, then they've missed the whole point. It's completely turned it all around backwards. Right? But that's coming from dialectics, from debate, that's all. And if you pull them up on their definitions of anything, then they won't have anything to say. And then their dialectics will stop, and then emotions and yelling and screaming will start. So not necessarily pleasant, but can be fun. Okay. So that ends that section. Then we'll go into the next. Means it's not the full section, but that part of it. So that will then continue with tomorrow. Right? So then we'll get into the personalities and everything about it, and then immediately go into the samskaras, and then into the brahmacharya ashram. So it should move along quite, you know, we're doing quite well. Yes?
May I ask, this point of self-satisfaction is the source of sacred law, based on...
Because it works, you can see it happening.
Yeah. So is this like when Srila Prabhupada is, you know, speaking, that, yeah, we can chant 16 rounds instead of 64, and he's following all the data, following this idea of love, that this becomes sacred law.
Means?
That's it, because he's following these three and he's understood it, realized it perfectly. Therefore, what he speaks is considered to be a sort of sacred law.
Yeah, you could say that, but a person like that goes into the third category. Here it's meaning for yourself. You've seen the law like that. You've seen that this is what a Shudra does. And so, therefore, you see that I'm comfortable doing that, and when I do it, it works and I get my pay. So therefore I can see that it's confirmed. So therefore I've applied the other three to my situation, it works. Does that make sense? So in other words, it started from shruti, from authority, and ended in pratyaksha. I can see it, right? We have a complaint when you start with pratyaksha. I can't see it, therefore it can't be true. So that, therefore, those personalities, they'll say the Bhagavatam is allegorical. Because because they're starting from the senses. And because they only trust their senses, they don't trust anybody else. They consider themselves the supreme authority. That's why they have a problem. But the point is, no, this is the way it is. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, the Shastra said something, he couldn't understand it, but he could find no evidence to support it. So, but he had full faith that it was there. Right, that. So then being anxiety like this, then at some point, I think, I can't remember who came, Lakshmi or someone came and said, in this Shastra, this verse is there that explains it. And then it was, but he had that faith, therefore he found out. You don't have the faith. Maya is very willing to take you off track. You don't have faith. She does great with that. That's easy. Taking a person who has faith and all that and distracting them, that's hard. But someone who doesn't have faith, bang, like that, very easy. Because there's no basis for their existence. It's just whatever they feel. Remember, it said the mind is the basis of the existence. So according to your mind, that's what body you're born into. That's why all these species of life and situations are there, because of your mind. So now if you make the mind as the basis of authority, then that means it is mundane. No ifs, ands, or buts. It's just mundane. But if you make Shastras the basis, then we're talking about something that can go beyond mundane. But if it's just your mind and what I feel and think and what I think is right, then that's not the source of life. It's one of them. That's why people will think, because I feel it, therefore it's real. So again, we see here is they're only taking that part. There's four parts, but they only take the one. Right? You know, you have all the other things that you have duties and all that, and of that, then liberality is the one for Kali Yuga. It's the only one that's, you know, function. And they'll take only that. You understand? And so this way they'll put together their philosophy. But they don't understand is they're taking parts of the Veda. Right? And that's why it seems to work. But when they go to apply it, because the other parts are missing, it doesn't actually work. It sounds great, but it doesn't work. You understand? So what we're talking is what the liberals are saying, and so far beyond it, they don't even know it exists. Right? Is that okay? Okay.
There was some point about receiving the reaction from the wrong thoughts also.
That's coming up.
Okay.
Yeah, means that'll come up. Like that. Means we've established the Brahmins have to give, but even now we're getting into detail within that. Yes?
So just to finish or clarify that aspect, what's the distinction between the dogma and the axial?
Dogma means you're unwilling to discuss it.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah. And axiom you don't have to, because it's obvious.
It's obvious, but you can discuss it to bring it out and show the logic of it and the foundation of it. You know, like that. But dogma means that there's no discussion, because that's what happens. Like they'll say, those who are traditional are dogmatic. Oh, you just that. But as soon as you question the liberal position, what do you mean by this word? Why do you say that's important? Immediately they'll come up and get angry with the idea that you won't discuss it anymore. So actually, they're the dogmatic ones.
Axioms also are not discussed.
But you can discuss. We're willing to discuss. You know, that there is God and Krishna is God. We'll discuss that. You know what I'm saying? But some religionists won't discuss that. You know, if you don't believe there's God, then you're a demon. That's all. You know.
For us, that's axiom.
Yeah. It's an axiomatic truth that can't be changed, because that's just fact. God made it that way. So, but you can discuss how it is like that, so that you see how it applies in your life and the situation. So we're very willing to discuss, you know, what do you call them? Axioms or axioms. Okay. So basically, this approach that we're using is from the axiom. What is that principle that always works? Like that, and what's the basis of those principles and those principles, so that we can see the lineage of them. then we can see, okay, in this, how would I apply that to this situation? Because that self-satisfaction means you as the manager should be satisfied and who you're managing should be satisfied. So that means the other three have to be applied to this fourth point. Okay? So, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jainatai Gaura Premanandi.
Hare Krishna. Bhakti Vinod Maharaj ki.